This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. Today we're going to take a look at the experiences of newly arrived immigrant children in America. How are they adapting? What are their ambitions? What are their frustrations? What challenges do they face? And how successfully are they meeting those challenges? Our guest this afternoon is Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He is one of the authors of Learning a New Land, Immigrant Students in American Society. The book is the culmination of an interdisciplinary study that followed 400 newly arrived children from the Caribbean, China, Central America, and Mexico for 5 years. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Marcelo Suarez Orozco is professor of globalization and education at New York University, where he also serves as co-director of immigration studies. Together with Carola Suarez Orozco and Irina Todorova, he is the author of Learning a New Land, Immigrant Students in American Society. The book is published by the Harvard University Press, and it is the recipient of the Virginia and Warren Stone Best Book on Education and Society. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Suarez Orozco, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome, and congratulations on this award.
Thank you. We're delighted.
Yeah, I would imagine. After all that work, too. What a wonderful, after all that work, years
exactly.
And years.
10 years in the making.
Yes. Well, immigrant children are the fastest growing segment of our youth population. How many children enter the U.S. each year?
Well, it's now we estimate that 1 in 5 children in the U.S. is the child of an immigrant. And what's really very important to keep in mind is that the share, the proportion of the children of immigrants is now the fastest growing share of the youth and child population. We now estimate that by the year 2040, 1 in 3, over 33% of all children in the United States, will be the children of immigrants. About a quarter of them are foreign-born. These are kids born in Mexico who migrate to Illinois, born in Haiti who migrate to Florida, born in China who migrate to California. So it is fascinating because our country, Celeste, is one of a handful of countries where immigration is both history and destiny. Immigrant children will remake our economy and our society simply because of the very profound demographic echo the last 20 years of large-scale migration has generated. Most of these children are citizen children, they're U.S.-born children, and they will be the key players in remaking the promise of our democracy, our economy, and our society. A very important topic, and unfortunately a topic that is not really in the radar screen when we debate immigration today.
Yeah, today's discourse, when we talk about immigration, are we talking about the right things?
No, we aren't. We should be focusing precisely on the long-term processes that will significantly affect the nature of our economy and our society moving forward. And I have been working in the field of immigration for 3 decades now, and we've, after many, many years, we've arrived at the consensus that really in the area of immigration, the story of the children of immigrants, the story of how these children will make the transition to citizenship, to the labor market, to the narrative of the nation, to belonging, will be decisive because of the tremendous growth in the population of immigrant origin youth. We seem to be caught on a number of really low-hanging fruit issues when we debate immigration. We need to take a step back and look at the broader picture. We need to look at how this has unfolded in the history of our country and how, moving forward, we want to engage these new youngest of the new Americans.
Mm. In the book, you tell the stories of kids you call declining achievers, low achievers, improvers, and high achievers. How many of all the kids that you studied, and maybe we should talk a little bit about the study. You began with 400 students, and at the end of the study, this longitudinal study, you had a little over 300 students left in as participants. But I want to know here at the top, how many of these kids were thriving and how many were struggling?
Well, we were able, because of the longitudinal nature of the design, it is in some ways the first study of its kind that can address the mechanisms by which the journeys of children really shift and the distinct pathways that they take over time and across nations as immigrants come to our country. What we discover in terms of the long-term trajectories of immigrant origin children is in some ways out of Dickens. It is the best of times, it is the worst of times. Immigrant children today are more likely than ever before in the history of our country to end up at Harvard College. I taught the first course in the history of Harvard University called Latino Cultures, and I would teach a course in a large auditorium with maybe 300 students. The first week of classes, I would ask them, how many of you are immigrants or the children of immigrants? Two-thirds of the kids would raise their hands. Right? This is really, truly new. This never happened before in the history of immigration to our country. 100 years ago, if you had asked the same question to any Harvard College class, you would have never had two-thirds of the kids raise their hands and say, yes, I'm Irish-American, yes, I'm Eastern European-American, yes, I'm Italian-American. That would have never happened. So on the one hand, for a share, for a group, for a percentage of immigrant children and the children of immigrants, coming to the U.S. in some ways is utopia realized. These kids are just thriving. In our study, we identified five distinct pathways. One of the important pathways is the pathway of children, youth, who arrive in our country, enter the system doing very, very well, and remain very engaged with schools. And by the end of the study, these kids are thriving. These are kids who are, they enter the system flying at 40,000 feet, and when they leave to going to college, they're flying at 40,000 feet. These are kids that are started from often humble origins and are now at Berkeley studying science. They're at MIT studying science. They are at really some of the leading scientific and scholarly centers in our country. I would say our data show that roughly a quarter of the children in our sample fit this pathway. These are kids that enter doing very, very well, and by the end of the study, these kids are just thriving. Unfortunately, the majority of the kids decline in their academic achievement and engagement over time. And we measure this in a variety of ways. And we use all the usual suspects. We use their kids' grades. We use their kids' English language acquisition. We use their kids, performance on standardized achievement tests. And there is an alignment here that tell a story that for example, another roughly quarter of the kids, about 24% of the children of immigrants, declined over time. There is a slow pattern of decline in terms of they don't do as well. They tend to get worse grades. They tend not to do better. For most alarmingly, another group of kids, roughly 27%, really decline in a precipitous fashion. These are kids that enter the system and they're doing pretty good early on in their engagements with our schools. And over time, and after 5 years, you see a real decline, for example, if you measure it by grades, of over almost two grades decline. So overall, it's Dickens.
Yeah,
it's the best
of times.
And for a lot of kids, a lot of problems. A lot of these kids are headed towards really frustrating options in the opportunity structure as they move into the labor market, because they're leaving schools really without the skills, without the competencies that increasingly are needed for immigrant kids and more generally for all kids to do well in an increasingly competitive, globalized U.S. Economy.
Can we take a call? Let's take
Certainly.
A call. Let's take a call. A listener would like to speak with you on a cell phone on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. I was wondering, now, with these immigrants that are coming here, a lot of them are Spanish-speaking. What I don't understand is, and don't get me wrong here, I don't have any ill will towards anybody who wants to come in this country to share our wealth and our, you know, fortune that we have here, but why do we have to change our speaking languages? Because right now it seems like the southern half is you have to speak Spanish first and English second. And I know of this because I actually have friends of mine that are teachers. Now they have to learn Spanish because they have to deal with the influx of, you know, Spanish immigrants. What about the Polish immigrants and the Lithuanians and the Russians? They do not understand this, and they can't understand why we're bending over backwards for more of an influential type, you know, immigrant situation, especially at the schools. I'd like your comment on that. And, I got one other comment. I'll hold on and listen.
Okay. Language is a big, important, very important issue. You want to tackle that?
Yes, excellent question. So what our data show, and what basically 100 years of basic research and experience in the field of immigration shows, is that immigrants over time gravitate towards English. Not only that, they are now learning English faster and better than ever before in the history of the United States. That's empirically, the data on this are overwhelming. But that may not be the right question. The right question might be, are they learning the kind of English they're going to need to thrive in the knowledge-intensive sector of the U.S. economy? And that's where we can have an interesting debate. In regards to the future of foreign languages in the United States, one of my good colleagues at Harvard University once said, the United States is a cemetery for languages. The Germans brought German, the Eastern Europeans brought various Eastern European languages, you mentioned Polish, the Japanese brought Japanese, the Italians brought Italian, all of these languages were buried in the United States. The question then is, well, what is happening with today's immigrants? And what I should say is that, yes, on the one hand, there is a very, very large group of Spanish-speaking new arrivals in our country. But that's, again, not the important piece of the story. The important piece of the story is that our country today is witnessing the most diverse, really hyper-diverse, wave of immigrants arriving into our society, speaking hundreds, literally, of different languages. I live in a city. I wake up in a city every morning, and I take the subway, where children from approximately 190 different countries get up, take the subways, take the buses, take the trains, and go to schools. Right? These kids speak literally over 100 different languages. And the magic of American society is that over time, all of these kids are really moving very, very fast into what we can call colloquial English. Unfortunately, they're also losing their home languages, which is increasingly problematic in the context of the global reality that now our economy, our security, our demography, our society in general is facing. So you may want to make the claim that a global power like the United States should aim to cultivate these languages because of the economic, because of the security, because of the diplomatic implications of having speakers of more than one language. So what will happen with Spanish moving forward? Again, Spanish origin immigrant children in our schools today are learning English much, much faster than, say, the Italian or the Eastern Europeans learned English 100 years ago. If you look at our historical experience, 100 years ago, our country was being transformed by large-scale immigration. Eastern European Jews, Irish, Italians were coming in huge numbers. They were coming to New York. They were coming to Illinois. They were coming to California, right? If you look at the data for the school completion rates and the transition into English for these groups, it was really breathtaking how few of the immigrants then completed any basic form of a high school education. The best estimates are that the Eastern European Jews, who were the most successful in using the education as they entered our country 100 years ago, in New York, for example, less than 5% graduated from high schools. Much lower the graduation rate for the Italians and for the Irish in New York were much lower. So it's obvious that the kids today, the immigrant kids, which is the topic of my research, are learning English. They want to learn English. Our data on this are overwhelming. Over 99% of the kids at the beginning of the study say they want to learn English. Most of the kids say they like learning English. Most of the kids say that learning English at an academic level is very hard. They struggle with this. But don't get me wrong. I've been doing basic research in the field of immigration for 3 decades now. I never met an immigrant parent who told me, I don't want my kids to learn English. Immigrants are rational actors. They vote with their feet. They migrate because they want something better for their children. And immigrant parents don't need our political class, our media folk, certainly not our researchers and academics, to tell them that their kids need to learn English. They know it. I have yet to meet an immigrant parent who tells me, I don't want my child to learn English. I want her to keep her Chinese. I want her to just be a monolingual Spanish speaker. That's not how most immigrants behave.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon is Marcelo Suarez Orozco. He is one of the authors of Learning a New Land, Immigrant Students in American Society. The book is the culmination of an interdisciplinary study that followed 400 newly arrived children from the Caribbean, China, Central America, and Mexico for 5 years. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, I know our listener wanted a follow-up, but he did ring off, so he might call in again later in the program. That would be okay. And we hope to hear from some other folks this afternoon as well. One of the things that I hope we can talk about before too much time goes past us is the students themselves, because this was my favorite part of the book, Learning a New Land, the profiles of the students, what they're feeling, what they struggle with, who succeeds and why. And I don't know who we should start with, what group of kids we should start with. Maybe because we were speaking of language, one of the stories that I really liked in the book, in the chapter you devote to high achievers, is you tell the story of a Chinese immigrant student named Joyce and a girl named Miriam. And Miriam was quite the advocate for Joyce. Do you recall the story?
Yes, I do very, very well. And in a way, the high-achieving kids, the kids that come to our country and really thrive, have a constellation of factors that really crystallize and have a huge impact in moving their experiences in a positive direction. In many cases, it is the kids that are able to establish deep and meaningful friendships and supports, both with their peers. We discovered, for example, again, in relation to the issue of the English language, that, for example, kids that had just one friend who was English dominant, who spoke English as a native language, was a very, very good predictor of how well that child, the friend, would learn English over time. We also discover that for the high-achieving kids, the gender piece is a very, very important piece. Many of the kids in our study, especially the girls, especially the Chinese origin girls, reported having tremendous responsibilities at home, a regime of really very demanding work in terms of helping out, in terms of supervising their other siblings, helping with the errands, translating for the parents in many cases. For these kids, particularly for the girls, going to school was really, it opened a kind of a social universe where they look forward to going to schools, and schools became a place for many of our immigrant origin kids where social relations, kind of a relational engagement with peers, also very importantly with mentors. The mentoring piece is a piece that is at the center of every one of the most successful stories in the course of our study. These were the kids that were able to connect with somebody either at school, sometimes a coach, sometimes a church, sometimes an NGO, maybe a tutoring, maybe an after-school club, maybe a homework club, organized by the ethnic community, where the kids connected with a non-family adult, and that connection, in many cases, was absolutely essential in easing the transition of these kids, particularly as they were moving through these complicated transitions out of the bilingual programs, for example, into mainstream classes, from middle school to high school. As the kids were making the transition from high school to college, these bridges, these links with non-family mentoring adults were absolutely critical. But for a lot of the Chinese girls, school is fun because they have a lot of serious, diligent work to do at home.
Mm. And to go back to the story, I love this story of Joyce and Miriam. You went to interview Joyce. I don't know which one of the researchers we're talking about really here, but one of you went and sat next to Joyce during lunch in the cafeteria. She's newly arrived from China. This is middle school, and she didn't speak English, and she had this little girl near her, sitting near her, and Miriam, and
yes.
Miriam said to the researcher, "Are you here to teach Joyce English?" And you explained that you were there for research. Someone else was to teach her English. And Miriam, though, she wouldn't let it go. She said, "You know, Joyce has to learn English. I want to say hi to Joyce, but she just looks at me." And then somebody suggested, one of the researchers, one of you suggested, maybe you can learn some Chinese and talk to her. So here you have the building of a friendship, of the importance of peers. Also, Miriam is one of the high flyers. Joyce is one of the high flyers.
Yes.
She came in at 40,000 feet, even though she had this huge challenge ahead of her to learn English.
Yes. But that interaction really captures a lot of the essential units here. These are the molecules in the chemistry of success. It's the link, as you've suggested, is the and the virtuous cycle that can be generated when you have an English dominant or an English monolingual student getting exposure to a newly arrived student from China. This could be the context for a win-win arrangement where our newly arrived immigrant kids can have the exposure to the language models that are needed for the acquisition of the English language. And at the same time, our native English-only speaking students can have exposure to another language, which, again, I would come back to the argument. I've taught at the University of California, I've taught at Harvard, I now teach at NYU, and to me makes so little sense that our students are paying $40,000 a year to learn foreign languages at our elite colleges, and this kind of bilingual resource that a lot of immigrants bring with them is going to waste. There's a tremendous opportunity here for the American kids to teach immigrant kids English and to model English for them, and for the immigrant origin kids to share their linguistic and cultural resources. We live in a global economy. We live in a globalized society. This should be an asset. We really should focus on how do we cultivate, how do we create more win-win, how do we create more partnership between the Joyces and the Miriams of the world.
Yeah. Well, now let's talk about another student. His name is Leon, and he is a Mexican immigrant, a student at Steeler High in California. He's one of the kids who's having a difficulty, to keep up with the metaphor here, keeping his plane off the ground. He's having a tough time. What would you like to tell us about him? He's one of the students profiled in the chapter on low achievers.
Yes, the metaphor that we use for some of these kids is, you know, spring is coming to New York and to New England, and I'm a gardener. Carol and I are both gardeners, so we use the metaphor of transplant shock. Some kids, in the context of migration, undergo this profound, really transplant shock, very, very similar to what happens to some plants when you move them. And there's a period where you really wonder and worry, are they going to make it or not? Many kids we've witnessed undergo this process of shock. These are the kids that tend to have the more difficult family relations. Their migration tended to be separations, the separations that are so central, the family separations that are so central to most immigrant journeys today, presented the most difficulties for these kids. These are kids that tended to have find themselves in more segregated neighborhoods, in more segregated schools. These were the kids that tended to go to schools where the majority of their peers were co-ethnics, but this is particularly true now of the Hispanic Latino origin immigrant kids. They are now the most highly segregated children in our schools. Latino kids are more segregated than African American kids now. So there is, again, a constellation of things here. There is a misalignment that generates, in many, many of these cases, a perfect storm where the kids are not getting the supports they need. They don't have really the social capital, let's call it, the relationships and the supports in the family that will help them in easing their transition to the new country. These are kids that often arrive in a kind of a traumatic context. Many of these kids left violence in their countries. And in a way, the misalignment of factors create very difficult contexts. A lot of these, particularly boys, find themselves not connecting with schools, not learning academic English. There is a lure for many of these kids either to the life of the gang, sometimes at the margins of gang, the gang wannabe sort of culture, or the world of work, where the pool of work is so important in terms of the needs of the family, mm-hmm. and in terms of the inability of the schools to really connect with these kids, that they end up either leaving schools. Some of these kids get into trouble with the law. Some of these kids end up in under the supervision of the California Youth Authority for the kids that were in the West Coast. There are a lot of broken dreams. There are a lot of missed opportunities. There is a lot of transitions in the life cycle where key interventions could have turned the journeys of these youth. And unfortunately, that's not the case in many, too many cases.
Yeah. That reminds me of the story of another student in the book, Lotus. She's profiled in the chapter of declining achievers, but
it's a very sad story.
But she is striving. She has this is so moving. Was so moving to me. She is a girl of some ambition and some dreams, and even though her family had low expectations for her, that seemed to kind of light her fire.
Yes, indeed. This is a very, very sad story where, again, there are gender expectations. There are problems within the family that have a history in the context of migration, in the context of the pre-migration story. And but here you have a case of human will, human agency, her own determination, her own sense that despite all the obstacles, despite the difficulty she has moving from one language program to another, moving from one school context to another, that she is going to she's going to fight. She's going to, and this is at the heart of, in a way, really most immigrant stories, the will to do better, the will to forge a better tomorrow for yourself, and most importantly, in most of these cases, for the family, to give back. But a lot of these stories are really about the missed opportunities as different turning points shape the journeys of these children, and what might have been had a mentor, had a family member, had a teacher seen the potential, seen the drive, seen the optimism, seeing the energy that drives people to migrate. It's very, very difficult to migrate. Migration is not for the faint of heart. It requires a tremendous amount of will, and it requires a tremendous amount of energy.
What is the story of the group you call the Improvers?
The Improvers are the kids that I guess we were all rooting for, in a way. These were the kids that we theorized at the beginning of the study that more immigrant origin children would follow this pathway. In other words, we all understood conceptually and because of other research and because of our own experiences how difficult it is to migrate. And we felt that immigrants arrive and they have a lot of challenges, learning the new language, learning the new system, learning, getting used to a new culture, a new society, new institutions, new schools. Everything is new when you're an immigrant. All the taken-for-granted practices that we internalize and we make part of our sense of self have to be learned again. So we felt that, in general, kids would be facing challenges during the early moments of their migration. But over time, again, as they learn more English, as their optimism, as their drive increasingly engages them with schools, more kids would improve, would get better grades, would do better in standardized tests, would do better in their English language tests, and the like. Unfortunately, only a small group, or a relatively small group of kids, only really 10%, 11% of the kids, 10.9% of the kids, fit this pattern. These are kids that began really getting C averages in their classes. By the end of the study, these kids had, you know, moved themselves to the B-plus range. So there was a significant improvement in terms of their grades. There was a significant improvement in terms of a number of other indicators. These kids tended overall to be in better schools than the kids that are either precipitous decliners or who, in a way, never do well when they arrive, the sort of low achievers who start very, very low, and they never quite get their bearings in the new society.
Yeah, so many.
The Improvers are the kids that tend to be in schools that are a little better. They tend to have relationships that tend to support their academic engagement. And over time, they have small triumphs, and these are kids that tomorrow looks bright for them.
So many variables. Let's go back and talk with our listener who joined us earlier this afternoon on line four. Good afternoon again.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for letting me back in. The other thing I wanted to say is I've got an experience with a neighbor of mine who is work through their church on sponsoring immigrants. One family in general was Burundians. And the thing I don't agree with here is that now that she was learning how to drive last weekend a vehicle, and she doesn't know how to speak the language quite yet. And the gentleman, my friend, that said it was the guy that was giving her a test said it would be okay as long as she understood the signs, the sign language, you know, the signs, you know, that are placarded out there, which this is where I get kind of frustrated. I mean, if I've got to learn to take a test, why shouldn't they? And that's where I think the big issue is. These children that are growing up as immigrants, I hope somebody will take them under their wing and teach them how to speak this language, still at the same time not losing their original language, because I believe that you ought to be able to speak both. I just don't understand why people have to change their methods and their of, you know, this country to satisfy somebody else. I think it ought to be the other way around.
I'm going to jump in here because we're way down on time now. I think in what the caller is getting at in part is that in it's kind of multifaceted here. I don't know. Why don't I let you, our guest, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, jump in here and make a comment?
Well, I'm not sure what the law or the regulations are in Illinois for the issue of driver's license and whether they have to take a test or not. What I would suspect is if there's a test, then everybody has to take the test. I don't know of a waiver that an immigrant would get that would mean, well, I don't have to take the test because I'm an immigrant. My sense is that immigrants are, right, they're not from the other side of the moon. They're like everybody else. So if you show up in the Parliament of Motor Vehicles and you have to take a test, you have to take the same test as everybody else. So it's not clear to me what the instructor was telling his neighbor. In some cases, immigrants can take the tests in their own languages. I doubt that in Champaign there is a Burundi language test. There may be a language test for one of the world languages, for Spanish or maybe for Chinese. But when you get into a context like the hundreds and hundreds of different African languages, I doubt that you can go and petition to take it in your home language.
Yeah, we have to wrap up now, and a couple of things I would think we could sum up here. That's what we need to do. But it seems to me that we need, on the one hand, to improve all schools for all children, and then for our immigrant children who are going to become so important to this country in the future, we need to make sure that they have what they need to succeed in it. You know, a friend, a mentor, an after-school program, it doesn't seem like a whole lot.
No, that's right. We need to have a conversation as to how are we going to think about these three fundamental mechanisms that are now really going to reshape our future. On the one hand, we have the largest number of immigrants in the history of our country. On the other hand, we have an economy and a society that is increasingly interconnected, that is increasingly globalized. And the third factor here is that we need to really have an agenda and a national conversation as to how we're going to educate all children, not just our immigrant origin children. What works for immigrant origin children is not so different from what works for our native children. We need schools that are engaging. We need schools that where the children's curiosity is fully developed and engaged. We need schools that are rigorous. We need schools that teach all our children to think increasingly in terms of both disciplinary domains, but also in terms of interdisciplinary ways of resolving problems. The problems the next generation will have are problems that are neither going to be neatly bounded by either nation states. There are no national problems anymore. The ozone layer, the environment, deep poverty, these are global problems. These are transnational problems.
There, I've got to interrupt you. I'm sorry to do that, but we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, Marcelo Suarez Orozco. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Our guest is one of the authors of Learning a New Land, Immigrant Students in American Society. The book has been awarded the Virginia and Warren Stone Best Book on Education and Society. The publisher, Harvard University Press.